we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualized, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualized.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reasons. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months. World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy. But we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than 2 decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between 150 and 200 euro is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
Leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite.
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalizing on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdullahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdullahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
On Tuesday, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni unveiled Italy's 2023 draft budget bill during a press conference held at the government building. The package features a $35 billion spending plan and fiscal policies focusing mainly on supporting families, self-employed workers and those on low incomes.
Due grandi priorità.
There are two big priorities: growth, which means safeguarding our production system, and social justice, which means focusing on families and on people on low incomes. This budget is the product of political choices, as is normal for a political government.
About two-thirds of the €35 billion budget bill will be allocated to measures aimed at helping struggling families and businesses with the cost of living emergency. Power bills have skyrocketed amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war, while Italy's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
Buying food, fuel, paying power bills, it's very difficult. We are struggling to make ends meet, and we expect this government to help us.
The government must ease tax pressure. We can't go on this way anymore. And the war in Ukraine should be stopped. All problems began with the conflict.
A flat tax rate on incomes of up to €85,000 for professionals and individual businesses is to be introduced, while the controversial citizenship wage basic income introduced by the Five Star Movement in 2018 is set to be reduced. Also, the pension system will be reformed to allow early retirement. The cabinet also discussed the 2013 Euratom directive, which deals with civilians being exposed to ionizing radiations. Euratom is the European Atomic Energy Community, which was set up in the late 50s to shape Europe's nuclear energy market. The draft budget bill will now be sent to Brussels for approval before it is passed. Max Civili, Rome.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aid are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States of America is a country that suffers from violence and daily killing of its citizens. But in the last months of this year, 2022, the level of violence and the use of firearms by the American people against each other has reached a peak. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper gives us more detail. According to the non-profit organization Gun Violence Archive, there have been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States so far, putting the country on pace to reach around 675 by the end of this year. Last year saw a shocking 690 mass shootings across the United States, up from 610 in 2020, and 417 mass shootings in 2019. The Gun Violence Archive database researchers said on Wednesday, 23rd of November, the country is three mass shootings away from 2022 being the second highest yearly total since we began tracking data. By Thursday, the country was just two shootings away from that dark milestone. At least five people were killed and a dozen and a half injured in a mass shooting incident at a nightclub in the U.S. city of Colorado Springs recently, and six individuals were shot dead on Wednesday, 23rd of November, at a Walmart superstore in Chesapeake, Virginia. According to the Gun Violence Archive, a total of 39,820 people have so far lost their lives in gun violence incidents in the U.S. this year alone. Over 18,000 of deaths were homicides, while around 21,500 deaths were declared suicides. The Gun Violence Archive researchers said after the Colorado incident, Gun Violence Archive had never logged a month of 60-plus mass shootings before 2020. It happened five times in 2020, six times in 2021, and now six times again this year. According to Gun Violence Archive, the U.S. has experienced an average of 1.68 mass shooting incidents per day so far this year. The 2018 Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the United States, or 120.5 firearms per 100 people. That number is much higher now, given the soaring increase in gun sales in the past few years. U.S. President Joe Biden in July admitted that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields and vowed to reinstate a ban on assault rifles. The remarks came in a White House ceremony to mark new gun control legislation that President Biden signed on 25th of June. Biden said, "This has taken too long with too much of a trail of bloodshed and carnage. The past many years, across our schools, places of worship, workplaces, stores, music festivals, nightclubs, and so many other everyday places, they have turned into killing fields." The Tehran Times has also covered the same story. Amid growing political polarization, more Americans are buying guns amid a climate of fear and insecurity. The United States has marked the third consecutive year that the country has registered more than 600 mass shooting incidents. The spike, documented by a prominent non-governmental organization, comes as a record number of Americans purchase guns amid a political landscape that fuels fears of violence amid growing polarization. The Gun Violence Archive has labeled mass shooting incidents as an American phenomenon and defines the deadly incidents as any attack in which there are at least four victims shot, injured, or murdered by a gun, but excluding the perpetrator of the attack. The latest statistics paints a disturbing picture of increasing gun violence in a country where there is so much political division that American news outlets are openly speaking about the dangers of a civil war. The latest figures have also been released as Donald Trump has announced his candidacy for a Republican presidential nomination in 2024, nearly 2 years after inspiring the deadly insurrection on Capitol Hill. The former president and his supporters strongly believe that the U.S. election was rigged in favor of his rival Joe Biden. Among Donald Trump's supporters are white supremacists and other armed extremist groups. Trump received more votes in the 2020 presidential election than he did in the 2016 presidential election. In 2020, the Republican candidate enjoyed the support of more than 70 million Americans, an indication of how many of the American public maintained support for Donald Trump's views and rhetoric. It also shows how polarized the United States has become. This is despite the many challenges facing Donald Trump, including the latest FBI raid on his Florida residence at Mar-a-Lago that angered his fan base, who have also expressed their strong belief in voter fraud in the last election. Experts say the deep divisions in the country, alongside the vast mass shooting incidents, will likely spark further turmoil in U.S. politics and potential violence among voters of the Republican and Democratic parties. The Insider website has also covered the same story and gives us more details. Following the Colorado shooting, President Joe Biden urged the country to address the public health epidemic of gun violence in all of its forms. President Biden said, "Earlier this year, I signed the most significant gun safety law in nearly three decades, in addition to taking other historic actions." It has been very clear that Biden's most significant gun safety law in nearly three decades has had no effect on the increasing figures of gun violence, as 2022 is set to go down in the history of the United States as a year during which the second highest number of mass shooting incidents took place. The other problem in the U.S. is that with the National Rifle Association, NRA, an extremely powerful gun lobby in Congress that advocates for the right of U.S. citizens to carry weapons. Opinion surveys show that only 52% of the American public actually support any form of gun control. According to polling by Gallup, only 11% of the population say that gun laws should be made less strict. Experts say this shows an environment of insecurity and fear that Americans live in. Not only are Americans concerned about political violence and the future of their democracy, but also the rising rate of crime in the U.S. Gun ownership significantly increased over the last few years. Earlier this year, research by the Annals of Internal Medicine found that 7.5 million American adults, under 3% of the population, became the first new gun owners between January of 2019 and April of 2021. These are the latest statistics from the Gun Violence Archive as of 24th of November 2022. The total number of deaths as a result of gun violence that involved all causes stood at just shy of 40,000 deaths, with 39,845 incidents documented. Homicides, murders, and unintentional deaths stood at 18,197. Suicides using firearms stood at 21,648.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea has made some major announcements. North Korea's President Kim Jong-un has said that building the nuclear force is the most important cause, adding that the new ICBM clearly proved to the world that North Korea is a full-fledged nuclear power and can stand against the supremacy of the U.S. What are the reasons for his announcements, and how will the U.S. react hearing that, especially since Kim Jong-un has said that North Korean scientists have made a wonderful leap forward in technology for mounting nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles? Just a few of the topics and issues we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, joins us from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, also joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, first to you. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, saying that his country aims to have the world's most powerful nuclear force. He said that while celebrating the launch of this new intercontinental ballistic missile. at a ceremony, which some were surprised to see his daughter. Not that it wasn't known how important nuclear weapons are to North Korea. Why do you think this is coming at this time and it being displayed in the way that it is?
Well, let's cast our minds back 4 years or so to the Donald Trump era, where actually Kim Jong-un and Trump were embracing each other, and actually there was a rapprochement going on. Trump had basically cut through all of the diplomatic nonsense that the State Department, it's almost like a firewall, really, with these bureaucrats at the deep state set up, and Trump had managed to cut through that in order to literally sit down with Kim Jong-un in North Korea and say, look, listen, you know, we can get along, we can start to trust each other from the presidential level down, you know, and that has all, it seems, been falling apart. But in the backdrop to all of this, and I think we've got to just look at the nuclear weapons era after the Second World War, as the United States became initially the sole controller of nuclear weapons, and other countries then got on the nuclear bandwagon. Well, of course, it wasn't a bandwagon because they realized that this was the weapon of the future, and anybody who had this weapon would be able to intimidate, you know, not only other countries but their own population into going along with various plans to do with possible wars. And so if you go back to 1956, where the British were attacked in Egypt and the Americans refused to help us, I think that was the right thing to do, actually, because it was the end of the colonial era. But the Americans at that point really started to, on a plan for what was an attempt at world domination. And I think that we have to just be realistic about this. The Americans don't say this. They never say this in any official capacity.
Right.
But anyone that pays attention to world affairs knows that that's what the United States wants. And there's only one thing which will stop you being dominated by the United States, it seems. And other countries like Libya, etc., Iraq, etc., have realized this, and that is nuclear weapons are the only things the Americans understand. If you've got nuclear weapons, they won't attack you. But if you haven't, they may do, and at some point they probably will do. And so I think the Americans have actually made this situation for themselves by the combination of being the first major nuclear power, with Henry Kissinger putting the strategy forward to all this, and then also by having the unified command structure around the world, where the US military attempts to dominate every inch of the planet. This is, I think, what's created the reaction from Kim Jong-un and nothing else.
Well, taking a look at what our guest at Tony Gosling said, Richard Becker, first of all, let's take a look at what this intercontinental ballistic missile is that Kim Jong-un is so raving about. It's called the Hwasong-17, dubbed a monster missile, believed to be capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Now, given the fact that they are now in possession of this, what do you think the U.S. is actually thinking, or how should it react? Or at this point, is the fact that North Korea is capable of having and making this type of intercontinental ballistic missile mean that it's not even interested in any negotiations on its missile capabilities?
Yes. So I do think that they are interested, very interested in negotiations, but there have to be real negotiations. In 2018, there was the meeting in Singapore, which your other guest referenced, which looked like it could move toward, a breakthrough. But in Hanoi in 2019, that collapsed. Negotiations collapsed suddenly. And according to CNBC, the network here, it collapsed because Trump came into that meeting with a piece of paper and written in English and Korean and saying that North Korea should turn over its weapons and its weapons-grade fuel, to the United States. And that was it. That was the end of the agreement. Now, that was really, we believe, Bolton and Pompeo. Bolton's been a longtime advocate of exterminating North Korea altogether. He was asked once what his policy was in regard to North Korea, and he said, no North Korea. So you had those elements take over. And whereas in 2018, there was an agreement to limit or halt testing but on the part of North Korea, if there was also an end to the so-called war games, which aren't really war games at all, by the U.S. and South Korea simulating invasions of North Korea. And this year, they were back at a very high level. That was in August. And they openly stated, the U.S. commanders openly stated that part of those military maneuvers, those war games, and you never know if they're games until they're over, but part of them was the assassination of Kim Jong-un, the leader of the country. The New York Times said he might have taken it personally. Well, no kidding. if the most powerful military in the world said, we're rehearsing to kill you or to assassinate you and to destroy your government, well, of course, you have to understand what that really means. So that's the reality of the situation, is that what was at one time appeared to be a promising steps toward normalization of relations, an end to the war. There has never been an end to the Korean War, the U.S.-Korea War. It's an armistice agreement, and the North Koreans very much want an end to this status of war. They want a peace agreement with the United States, and they want a lifting of the economic sanctions, which have done so much damage to North Korea and the people of North Korea, as they have to so many other countries in the world.
I'm going to ask you the same question, Tony Gosling. I mean, we could take a look at the previous attempts that were made by the U.S. And North Korea in terms of trying to reach some kind of a deal. But aren't we looking at a new landscape now? I mean, we're looking at a landscape where in Russia is somewhat disconnected from the West, in a matter of speaking. They're not really interested in the West, and they're shifted, really aligning themselves with China. Do you think North Korea is still very much interested in wanting some kind of a deal with the U.S. in particular for sanctions to be lifted, given the fact that, I'm guessing that China is one way or another backing North Korea?
Well, it's a very important point, yes. I mean, in a way, North Korea is just a kind of policy maneuver of China that it can do at arm's length. So it can, what they're doing through, I think, in North Korea is much of the things that the Chinese would like to say and like to do, but the Chinese are far, far more sensible, and they're trying to keep a good diplomatic relationship with the United States. But the U.S. has caused so much trouble for itself by throwing its weight around and trying to, well, I mean, what they've done is they've used this economic warfare for the last 20 years to bully and badger various countries around the world. And what's been the result? Well, it's meant that the U.S. is not trading with so many countries now that actually the U.S. economy itself is collapsing. And the Chinese are doing very well out of this. I mean, they've got a very well-oiled, and they've got actually quite a well-organized state in China, whereas the state in the U.S. and much of Western Europe is starting to collapse. The big corporations taking over, the government, basically finding it almost impossible to get in tax revenue because it's so weak. And so I think it's quite clear that, yes, the North Koreans do want to negotiate with the United States. But the thing is, as Vladimir Putin said, I think it was about 8 months, maybe a little bit longer ago now, the beginning of 2022, I heard him say something in one of his speeches along the lines of, well, the United States is not deal ready. This is a great expression because he's saying we can sit at the table with them all day, but we cannot actually get them to make a deal that they'll stick to. And they might even say something, but then they'll go away and they'll say, oh, we're very sorry, but our diplomats back in Washington have told us that we can't do this. So he's saying that to a certain extent, although they're always willing to sit down and talk to the United States, they're finding that they're basically banging their heads against a brick wall. And that is because the deep state in the U.S. is in free fall, rather like the last days of Rome, when the Roman Empire was so corrupt on the inside that the various machines of diplomacy stopped working for the Romans, and of course their empire then stopped working. And I think we're seeing a similar sort of collapse with the US now. Many people would love to do deals with the United States, sensible, mature, adult deals, which would see all their people's successful growth of trade in the future, trusting relationships. Mm-hmm. But we've got a deep state in the US that doesn't want that to happen because it's afraid of its own position. What we've seen is that, you know, there's various problems at the center of the US, not least of which has been revealed by the Epstein scandal. And these people are worried that if law and order breaks out in the international community, that the United States, the leaders of the deep state in the United States, the organized criminals, basically, may be just going to jail or worse, maybe being executed. So they're fighting a rearguard action, which is affecting their relationship with the entire world.
This is a very curious situation, Richard Becker, when you take a look at the landscape in that part of the world in terms of what the U.S. is doing. And my question to you is whether the U.S. does not want tensions to decrease. Now, when I say that, I mean the U.S. is busy trying to militarize. I shouldn't say trying to militarize the region. It's selling arms to the countries in that region, especially to the ones that are allied to it. Now, one of the main reasons it's doing that is, aside from North Korea, is the ultimate goal of China, because we know, obviously, the U.S. has a focus on China. And it does not want tensions then to be reduced, because it could continue with these arms sales like it did with Japan. Japan said that I'm going to quadruple my defense spending. I'm going to buy all these missiles, especially howitzers, I think, which reach deep inside mainland China. It wants to keep that at that level because it's going to somewhat be preparing not only itself, but its allies in the region to confront China ultimately. Do you think that that's the correct way of looking at it?
Well, I think that there's no question that the pivot to Asia, as it was called, is aimed first and foremost at China. But North Korea also has an important role now in the relations between them are strong, it appears, as they are between North Korea and Russia. And Russia and China, but particularly China, is the main target of the pivot to Asia and this huge buildup, which has seen vast deployment of U.S. military forces, increased military forces. There were already vast forces there in the Indo-Pac Command, as they call it, the Pacific Command, and this is an important factor in this. And the military buildup in Japan is also, it's also worth noting, Korea used to be, was for decades, a colony of Japan. And now the right wing and the militarists in Japan, they find it intolerable that they don't have nuclear weapons when their former colony does. North Korea being half of what that former colony was. And that's a big issue in Japan among the right wing. And if the as this process continues, the military buildup on the part of and nuclear buildup on the part of Korea, the pressures inside Japan grow for Japan to become also a nuclear power. The U.S. does not want Japan to become a nuclear power. It wants Japan to continue to be subordinate to the United States. And Japan is occupied. The occupation of Japan has never ended since the end of World War II. Tens of thousands of troops are all over Japan and Okinawa, as well as other bases in the area. But particularly Japan and Okinawa are key bases for the U.S. Military strategy in regard to Asia and its strategy of domination of Asia and global domination.
That's a very good point that you're making there. Since you mentioned China and Russia, Tony Gosling, I'm looking at a couple important points there on China. One of them, which involves Russia also, is that the U.S. says that both Russia and China have the ability to have leverage on North Korea to stop them from conducting these tests, and it wants to see Russia and China do that. It's not as if you've been hosting Russia and China in such a cordial, warm manner, you know, right. when you then come out and make a, I don't want to say demand, but asking both of them to do that. Why should Russia and China do that for the U.S.?
Well, they're not going to, I don't think, because actually what Kim Jong-un is doing is serving a very useful purpose, particularly for the Chinese. I mean, he is saber-rattling for the Chinese, I think, it's fair to say. The Chinese would much rather not be, going for any confrontation. And obviously, at the moment, there are all sorts of domestic problems the Chinese have got to cope with demonstrations against the continued lockdowns and this sort of thing going on within China. It's serving, I think, a useful purpose, and it's very unlikely. When I say a useful purpose, I mean countering the bullying of the United States, effectively, and saying, well, look, you know, if you can play at this game of making nuclear threats, so can we. And although the United States isn't necessarily making those on CNN, what it's doing is it's moving its forces closer to China, and it's surrounding China. It's threatening to blockade China, basically, by its military manoeuvres. But I think that where the solutions might come to all of this, we need to look closely at there are high-level connections between the United States and China, which very rarely get talked about. There was a very good discussion about all this recently by James Corbett and Whitney Webb, two very good freelance journalists, who I'm sure some of your viewers will know, at looking at the connections between the two. Now, this is a kind of deep state connection between the US and China. And so I think if there is going to be any dropping of these tensions, and of course, if that happens, that what we'll see is less saber rattling from Kim Jong-un and less saber rattling from the United States, maybe even some US troops going home from places like Japan, we were just hearing about, and in other places in the Pacific. That's where this should start. But of course, there is also a very important party in all of this, and that is the arms lobby. The arms lobby are pushing so much of US policy. They are very, very close to, obviously, the military, the State Department, and the US government. And they are the people, I think, that are pushing all these saber-rattling and the tension, because they will simply make money out of any kind of conflict. Although, you know, many people think, well, we don't want a war. Why does anyone want a war? The arms lobby love wars. I hate to tell you, but they do, because they make a fantastic amount of money at it. And right. In the United States, they have the ear of Congress. They have the ear of President Biden. And the sorts of fear-mongering that the arms lobby come out with, but I'm afraid, is the talk of the president and other people that talking about China and North Korea as a big threat, actually pushing their armed forces closer to these countries. And that is actually the arms lobby speaking. It's not the democratic people of the United States by any means.
Well, but to what degree is this, U.S. military going to go, even though they're interested, as our guest there said, the arms lobby is interested in these conflicts when we're talking about nuclear conflicts? I mean, Richard Becker, taking a look at what's happening in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. So you have a nuclear armed country there that the U.S. and Russia have exchanged statements amongst each other, with Russia at least proposing the idea of perhaps the use of nuclear weapons, even though it has said on many occasions that it's not going to do that. Or when it comes to the case of North Korea, of which the U.S. has also, in reaction, for example, gone ahead and has its B-52 bombers, for example, flying over. Even China itself has nuclear bombs. And also looking at the region in the West Asia, or the Middle East, as some call it, its ally, Israel, that has nuclear bombs. I mean, these are tensions around the world involving nuclear weapons. And the common denominator here is the U.S.
That's right. And, you know, it's not that China wants to rule the world or North Korea wants to rule. That's not true. But it is true that the United States wants to rule the world. I mean, it's the policy, the national security strategy changed in 2018 to one of away from the war on terrorism, so-called, to major party competition or major party conflict. It's clear what that means. You know, and we have to remember when in the longer term context, that it was in February, I believe, of 2002 that Bush gave his infamous speech and the State of the Union, and it talked about the axis of evil. And it was a ridiculous speech, but very threatening to those who were the target, mainly the axis of evil being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iran and Iraq had a war, an eight-year war with each other. They weren't exactly allies, and neither were allies. They might have friendly relations, but not allies with North Korea. And then what happened? Iraq was destroyed. its state destroyed, and it remains destroyed today by the U.S. And then we have Libya was persuaded to give up its weapons programs, turn them over to the U.S., and then Libya was destroyed. So it was after the destruction of Iraq and the second Iraq war, U.S.-Iraq war, that North Korea resolutely set out that we're going to have a nuclear program, we're going to have nuclear weapons. They had been doing research before, but that really triggered the decision to go forward, we believe. And that is understandable. If you can't be able to respond to your adversary and your adversary is threatening your existence, well, you have a big problem. And so, you know, I think that's the context we have to see this in, is that it has been, as you said, the common denominator being the U.S. and its vast nuclear weapons program. It should also add, North Korea probably has 40 nuclear weapons at this point, maybe a little bit more than that. They can develop 6 or 7 a year. The United States has over 6,000 nuclear weapons and can destroy the entire planet with its nuclear arsenal in case of war. And that's where the great threat comes from in terms of nuclear weapons and what they can do to humanity and to the world that we live in.
Indeed. And that's something that obviously is taken notes with countries that the U.S. accuses of pursuing nuclear weapons, which one of them could be Iran, that is not trying to in any shape or form pursue a nuclear weapon, but is going after a civilian nuclear program. Now, Tony Gustin, in closing, you know, when you talk about the U.S. wanting to be a superpower in pretty much all over the world, as our guest there said, and I think you mentioned that in some sense, why is the U.S. on that track? It's not successful. It can't even control. I just looked it up real quick, a Google search in Washington, D.C., where it has the highest crime rate. If you can't control your own state, how are you going to control the world?
Well, we have exactly the same problem here in the UK. The government has made a total mess of domestic policy. We've got poverty going through the roof, homelessness going through the roof. And so what they always do is they focus on foreign policy. This is just a distraction, effectively, from the complete failures of them to run their own economies. And, you know, slapping the biggest example is the oil companies holding the government in Europe and the United States to ransom, jacking up energy prices, which makes nuclear power actually more viable and just about viable, as they're price fixing upwards all of the fossil fuels, saying they're doing something green, but what they're really doing is just helping the nuclear industry. And so I think, you have to also remember that I think it was the Gray Zone, one of these websites recently, is alleging that actually Zelensky in Ukraine has been helping the North Koreans over the years to get their nuclear weapons programs. Of course, the Ukrainians had a lot of ex-Russian nuclear weapons.
I got to unfortunately jump in, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry about that, Tony Gosling.
Between Ukrainians and North Korea, too.
Sorry about that. We're just fresh out of time. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist. Thank you. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, Answer Coalition from San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next Spotlight, it's goodbye.